thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Hello.
Here's John Williams.
Who? Hi, it's me. My name is John Williams. I work here. Just didn't last week. But we're back in the studio.
Lord have mercy.
Weekdays from 1 to 3, don't you know? And Saturdays from 10 a.m. till 12 noon on social media, WGN King John. We do a news clip on our webpage and Facebook pages, too. Where we ask you a burning question of something in the news. And each day, it seems on Mondays anyway, the news click question, the burning question is, okay, now what's the matter with the Bears? So that's the new news click. We'll ask you what you think about yesterday's loss, bizarre loss, sad, tragic loss to the New England Patriots. We were that close. The question today asks you, what do you think of the Bears now? You were encouraged. You're not sure, or you are utterly discouraged by what happened yesterday. Vote with your mouse, and we'll see what the results are as the show moves along. Good to be back in the Allstate Showcase studio, the Skyline studio. One good thing about being away, I mentioned something like this the last time I took a couple of days off, but I'm going to do it again. One good thing about the world these days is that it's pretty easy to go on vacation. Now, you worry, or at least used to, that you were going to miss something crazy, but now every day is crazy, so you just assign to yourself the fact that cuckoo banana things will happen while you're gone, and hey, there's a fudge stand. You know, you're just like, but you know, we're in Michigan. There's a fudge stand. Brenda and I spent 72 hours in Michigan, never more than 20 feet from one another.
That's very specific.
Yeah, that's what happens, though. I mean, you know, you're in your car and you're driving around, and then you go to a fudge stand and you get back in the car and you stay in a little, you know, vacation rental place. And, you know, we were kind of tethered for a few days. In fact, it was that way for the 7 days that I was gone, never more than very far from each other. We've got a little condo. We drive around in the car. We go to a restaurant. Maybe we saw the kids. We go for a walk with the dogs.
So you're saying today's a great day for Brenda?
I think she's smiling.
I'm going to go put gas.
Yeah. I'm going to go to Indiana to get gas for the car.
It's cheaper.
I rediscovered that my wife Brenda is also the sort of person who will do some play-by-play of the world as we go by. She'll say a fudge stand.
I've found that people don't like that. I do the same. I'll read like a sign.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, my sister or whoever's like, all right. I'm like, all right.
Fluent in the language, sis. I know what that is.
I'm acknowledging this sign. So now you're acknowledging this sign.
A big tree. Yep. But we don't mind it, and we sort of discovered that we both do it. Driving near Sawyer, Michigan, I'll say, Sheer Madness Hair Salon. Huh. And Brenda doesn't respond because it really doesn't require a response, but we both sort of make announcements of things. Coming up on the crest of a hill. That's a blue sky. As you look at the blue sky, I don't know that this is the province exclusively of people who are older, A, because we're not, but B, I think we were probably inclined to be this way when we were younger. Plus, I like massive amounts of silence in the car when I'm driving, and it's not an uncomfortable, awkward, don't talk to me sort of silence, but I didn't want the radio on much. Even though we could hear WGN radio, I didn't want to listen a lot to this radio station, but then I would have drawn myself into work. Oh, would I have done that, guest? What should we do? What kind of questions do you ask? So I just kind of went away a little bit and just thought, hey, here's a fudge stand.
That's nice. You need that.
You really do. You really do.
How was the fudge?
That's the most important question.
Didn't stop to get the fudge, but I tried a lot of the, bourbon that they're now distilling in Michigan, and we had some wine and some beer and some food. Just, you know, drove around and ate and looked at stuff.
Any good baked goods then? Because, you know, I'm a sugar person.
There was a bakery we went to. Well, it was actually a breakfast joint along the Red Arrow Highway that goes, you know, from New Buffalo and Sawyer and Three Oaks and all the way up the eastern coast of Lake Michigan there. And we got some Swedish pancakes that are worth the drive. And some Canadian bacon. Oh, man, that was lovely.
Amazing.
And, you know, you have to appreciate this about Chicago. You know, they talk about the vaunted Chicago plan, which, you know, 100 years ago, they said that nobody will build on the other side of Lakeshore Drive. It'll be parkland open to the people. And it's like, yeah, whatever. But then you drive around the lake and you realize how fantastic that vision is. We take for granted, maybe we don't, maybe we certainly shouldn't. But when you drive up and down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, you know what you see? You see the lake, you see park, you see beaches. Other cities, and in fact in Michigan, when you drive along the lake, you know what you see? The backside of people's houses who are lucky and rich enough to have property on the lake. You don't see the lake. It's right there. You see it in the openings between 2 yards. Oh, there's the lake. But except where you're in New Buffalo and you drive out to the public beach and it's a big, well-developed area with condos, you really don't have the sort of, I don't know, vision that Chicago does. I mean, really, think about that. Chicago from, you know, the turn on Lakeshore Drive north, heading to Evanston, all the way down to northwest Indiana. It's just gorgeous. And then you make the turn and you're starting to come north, and as close as it is, and it's beautiful terrain, but you just don't get to see it that much. So well, props to Chicago for all that.
And good for those people that live on the shore there.
I know, right. Like, you know, you don't want that kind of property, but you want a friend who has that kind of property because, like, there was one house. So we do that. We go, well, let's look that up. Brenda looks up a house on her phone. And it was a nondescript house as we're going through Beverly Shores or one of these lakeside towns. But it was a nondescript house, you know, like a little gray bungalowish looking thing. 3-bedroom, 2-bath, maybe 1.5-bath, $1.4 million.
Sheesh.
Welcome to the lake.
Exactly. It's the water.
Speaking of the architecture and lake, I was last I was here was the weekend that Chicago had the open house with the Architecture Foundation, where you were able to go to a couple hundred different buildings in Chicago that you've seen but otherwise wouldn't have access to. Violetta poo-pooed the idea when we brought it up a couple of Fridays ago.
Poo-pooed the idea.
Well, I actually drove by one of those sites. I'm like, hey.
Look at that. They're doing that thing where you can go in there.
Yeah.
You know, but the one I... Go ahead, V.
But I was just like, oh, well, I missed it because it was so, like, it's like you blink and it's over.
Well, it's a weekend and you drive by that. And then there's another place. The House of Blues was on there. The London House was on there. The old post office that you drive under off the Eisenhower.
See, that one is cool.
So I made a point to go over there and look at that because I wanted to kick around the bowels of that building and see the dusty,
what's in there?
Thing. They only let you see the lobby.
Oh. Well, what's the lobby look like?
It's fantastic. It's all finished in golden and marble and, you know, columns and real cool architecture. But it's just the lobby. And that whole massive building project, which you really want to kick around, is closed off. Nobody can go in there yet.
I want to go to the one room where that Blackhawks, you know, if you drive underneath,
right.
Yeah, you can see the Blackhawks sign. And oh, it's been there since they won the Stanley Cup in like 2000,
oh,
whatever.
Yeah.
That rings a bell. Why did you poo-poo it? I don't remember now.
No, I just
didn't. Well, in general, she just didn't think it sounded like fun to get out and traipse around.
No,
I
did.
Okay, here's the place that I traipsed around that was really cool. So I went to, you know, the bridges that go over the Chicago River here, Michigan and State and so forth. They all have those little bridge houses next to them on either end.
Mm-hmm.
That's an actual place where somebody would go. And then down below in those bridge houses are giant metal gears that when the bridge goes up on either side, those gears are turning and interlocking and lifting the thing up and then bringing the thing back down. Well, you get to go in there and kind of see those things. And in fact, if you're lucky enough, they happen to raise the bridge, you actually see the bridge get raised.
Ooh.
Here's the fascinating thing. I always thought it would take an enormous amount of energy or expense to lift the Michigan Avenue Bridge on either side. Think of all that steel and concrete. It's a big old honking thing. You've got to lift it up and then carefully set it down. And it happens so perfectly. The amount of energy it takes to lift either side of the Michigan Avenue Bridge is equivalent to that of a Volkswagen Beetle engine running. That's all. You know why? Because instead of having to lift the whole bridge, on the other side of the bridge, which you don't see, buried below the river level, is a hole. And in that hole is a 12,000-ton counterweight. So while the bridge is going up, there's really what's powering it is this falling weight on the other side. It's like a lever or a fulcrum. And so, because I've always wondered, how do they lift these things? It must, like, somewhere the utility bill's going zzzzzzz. But no, it's just they throw a lever, and now that brake is released, and now the weight on the other side just goes, ooh. So it's just a little motor.
That's physics right there.
Brr, totally. So it's just, brr, it just brings it up, and then brr, it takes it back down. And it's not that much of a deal because it's perfectly balanced. And if it ever gets out of balance, say there's ice on the bridge or a new coat of paint that messes up the weight, then they have these 500-pound additional weights they add on to perfectly balance it again. So there's just, you know, you're not being charged for that. You didn't have to tool around Violetta with us folks. I've just taken you on a tour of that bridge house.
Well, that one was cool. And so was there someone in there waiting for you to explain all that?
Sometimes there was, depending on the place you went, and sometimes there was not. We'd go into some places and there'd be a kind of a docent to tell you a little bit about the building. In this case, you just read the signs because it is tourist friendly. You could just walk around and look and see these sorts of things. So next year when they do the Open House Chicago, that is my recommendation. I will not be here when that happens, as I have bought tickets for both the Mega Millions and the Powerball. One other fun statistic. I bought a ticket to the Mega Millions, actually three, to increase my chances.
I don't think that's how it works.
And I know, really, buying 100 tickets to the Powerball or Mega Millions does not statistically increase your chances of winning.
I know people keep saying that, but I still don't really get it.
No, it's still like one in a zillion or one in a zillion.
Yeah, but
zillion.
You have two in a zillion, like a, then.
Right, two in a zillion. Two in a zillion is not enough, right? You need so many tickets to have an appreciable chance that you couldn't afford it. You couldn't physically buy that many tickets in the week. But anyway, I was wondering, since I have both tickets in my pocket, what are the chances that I would win both? Because that's where my mind goes. We don't say thinking big thoughts so you don't have to around here for nothing. Okay, a little bit about the chances. And the most unusual statistic I discovered about that in a minute. We don't have any dice around here, do we? Any dice? If we find one, let me know. Violetta, how many times do you think, say I gave you a die, six-sided, right? And I said, roll it. What are the chances that you'll get a one? It's one in six.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
How many times in a row would you need to roll a one in a row to have the same chance as winning the Powerball?
A trillion.
A trillion. The correct answer is 11.
Oh.
Your chances of winning the Powerball are the same as taking that die and rolling a one 11 times in a row. Well, doesn't
Oh,
that,
in a row.
In a row, yeah. But I mean, well, I mean... If I gave you all day, I
thought you just meant 11.
So here's what you can do. You can go home to your kids or grandkids and say, hey, listen, I'm going to give you a die. Give them a die. This is like you don't want them to play their video games or watch TV all day long. Say, hey, go in the other room.
Just teach them to gamble.
And roll a one. If you can get that same one to come up 11 times in a row, Grandpa's going to give you $1 billion.
Now,
and then you don't have to worry about them for the rest of the day.
Now, if you get the one 11 times in a row, does that qualify you more likely to win the Powerball as well?
Or, is the karma going to rub off?
I mean,
I like your sort of.
I would get mad if I got the die 11 times and then didn't win the Powerball.
Right. You go, really? I wasted my good luck. I wasted my 300 million to one chances on that, Grandpa? No, I should have bought the lottery ticket. Violetta's theory about where and how to buy a lottery ticket, I think, would be validated by a lot of us. And that is what?
Well, I asked you, did you buy your tickets from somewhere remote because you were just traveling and you weren't in Illinois and you're on the back roads? Everybody knows you're more likely to win if you buy a ticket from the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I have heard that more
this past
couple of weeks.
There's a
million-dollar winner in Oak Lawn. There was one in Chicago.
Nah, that's not fake news.
It's not going to be on state and, you know,
right.
Illinois.
It's never a real big, obvious, regular place. They always bought it from the Super America in Timbuk 6. That's where they bought it.
So where did you get your tickets from? Because they might be winners.
I bought it at the... I bought it in Chicago on Broadway at a 7-Eleven. I know.
You had such a good chance.
I just made it more difficult for me to win now. Listen, I read a couple of books while I was gone. One is The Fifth Risk by Michael Lewis, which is fascinating. We may yet talk to him. He's on the bestseller list and was therefore unavailable. But The Fifth Risk is about what it's like when you have a transition from one administration to another and how, in particular, this administration has handled that. You've probably heard a little bit about it. There's another book out right now called The Apprentice, Trump, Russia, and the Subversion of American Democracy by Greg Miller. It's not a good title, but what it is it's about the Russian hack. And it is fascinating. John Williams back from vacation. Thanks to Pete McMurray and all of the people that filled in for me while I was gone, and L.F. Garris, my producer, for coordinating all of those people and all of those topics and all of those guests.
She said it was easy.
It's like
a completely different show every day.
I got an email this morning or text message from Pete McMurray, who fills in a lot when I'm gone, and he said, "Oh, my God, you owe that woman a lunch."
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, probably."
And that was just for working with Pete.
I know. So as it turns out, we know a lot more about the Russian hack than you think we know. Or at least Greg Miller does. The national security reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner has looked into the Russian election hack. His book, The Apprentice, is amazing. Each page is filled with anecdotes you don't know about, or ones that you kind of know about, but in detail you did not think possible. Who cracked into the DNC from Moscow? Here's the name. He's actually got the name of the person that in Russia hacked into the Democratic National Committee. And exactly how did they do that? He's got it. The details of John Podesta's compromise make you laugh in dismay. Podesta got one of those fake, you need to change your password emails from Google. He didn't need to change it. It was the Russians. But his people clicked, and now the Russians had 50,000 Hillary Clinton email. And when the FBI figured some of this out, they called the Democratic National Committee. You've probably heard about this too, but it's still maddening. The FBI was put onto the IT help desk at the DNC, and that person there really didn't believe them. So it was 8 months of the Russians looking into the Clinton campaign and the DNC before anybody took it seriously enough. So as not to give themselves away when they were posting on websites and blogs, Miller says the Russians watched House of Cards to brush up on their American political lingo. How did WikiLeaks get the data? And what special kind of train wreck was Paul Manafort, the sobbing, nearly broke, in therapy con who became Trump's campaign manager? It's all there. Oh, and hello, George Papadopoulos. Nice to meet you. There's the who, what, why, where, and when of Christopher Steele. The story starts with a computer ping in the Netherlands and ends not far away with a bizarre press conference in Finland. You remember Helsinki? Greg Miller's on the phone. Greg, you're on WGN in Chicago. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much.
I think rather than interview you, I'm just going to read your book on the air now.
Could I get the script you were just using? Because that was awesome.
The book, it really is that. And it seems like every day there's a new development. In fact, before we just go into the details of the stuff that you uncovered, I wanted to ask you if you thought you saw any parallel between the relationship between Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Russia and the United States. In that, in the book, you say sometimes when the Americans see the Russians clicking around on a White House server or a Defense Department server, they don't immediately tell them or anybody. They watch to see what they're doing, what they're knowing, what they do with that information. Where does it surface on the other end? And it sort of sounds like maybe the Turks had the same sort of relationship with the Saudis at the embassy, right?
Isn't it interesting? I mean, what we've learned, most of what we've learned over the past couple of weeks about the murder of my colleague at the Post, Jamal Khashoggi, we've learned because Turkey wants us to learn, and we're learning stuff that Turkey knew from the very beginning. It's an interesting insight into the capabilities of a formidable intelligence service like the Turks have. And they have been just sort of using it in a drip, drip, drip way to go right after Saudi Arabia, who is a regional and religious rival for the government of Turkey.
And it's possible they would have a video or an audio, but they don't want to say that because then the Saudis know that they have a plant or that they're monitoring them somehow.
You know, there's another parallel here or another connection I would make and tie it back to Russia, if you'll let me. It's that, President Trump and his reaction to this, it's so much like the way he has reacted to Putin, you know, always sort of listening to Putin, giving Putin the benefit of the doubt, Putin's strong denials that Russia did anything in 2016. We've heard Trump use almost exactly the same language in connection with the Saudi claims about the murder of Khashoggi.
Well, I understand how Saudi Arabia is a regional player of importance, and there may even be financial ties between the Kushner and Trump families and some people in Saudi Arabia. But really, why are they so hesitant to call out these bad actors?
It's one of the, you know, biggest mysteries about this administration. But I think that the most compelling kind of argument or case is that it does come back to sort of these financial connections. Trump tried to tweet a week or so ago that he has no financial interests in Saudi Arabia, but that was a pretty carefully worded statement. We know that a lot of his properties, a lot of Trump condominiums and Trump towers, a lot of things have been purchased by wealthy, wealthy Saudis and oligarchs from Russia, and those are deep, deep connections that are hidden, that Trump has tried to keep hidden, but that help us to understand his behavior toward the autocrats in those governments.
Well, it would be a shame if it was that mercenary, but he says it's more for the country, right? That, in fact, we would lose a significant arms buyer if we, say, cut off arms sales to Saudi Arabia. I hear those numbers are a little suspicious, but I wonder if you'd comment on that angle of the story.
His numbers are exaggerated. It's certainly true that Saudi Arabia buys large numbers of arms from the United States, has used some of America's weapons in its ongoing campaign of destruction in Yemen, a very bloody and devastating conflict now stretching on for 4 years. But, I mean, ultimately what you're saying then is that these arms sales matter more than the principles that the United States is supposed to stand for, including freedom of the press, freedom in general. If you're willing to say that we need to protect those arms sales and tolerate the killing of a Saudi dissident.
Did the Russians aid the Trump campaign specifically? Do we know that that was an objective of theirs?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There is no doubt about it. I think there was only a few people who would argue that point now, and those are include the president and a few of his closest relatives. But no, I mean, we've known that for a year, and the evidence just gets stronger and stronger. In fact, you now know, I think we are much closer to being able to say that it was not just Russian interference seeking to help Trump, but that it had a big impact. We now know, we didn't know then, we now know that Facebook, for example, has learned that more than 126 million Facebook users in the United States saw Russian propaganda, pro-Trump propaganda in 2016. This is in an election where only 130 million Americans voted.
Yeah, but that's different than did they help them directly. For instance, you could lob that stuff, make posts about terror or race or things that agitate Americans. But I'm asking you, did they reach out to the Trump campaign and say, what buzzwords should we use or how can we help you?
I misunderstood your question. I think that they attempted to. I think that there's still some argument over the purpose and nature of the Trump Tower meeting. I think there was a lot of interaction between the Trump campaign and Russia that was out in the open, a lot of signaling of messaging and so forth that they were reacting to. And I don't think there's any question based on, you know, the conclusions of U.S. intelligence agencies that Russia was trying to help Donald Trump. But whether there's a smoking gun sort of explicit memo articulating an agreement to throw the election, we haven't seen that yet, and maybe Robert Mueller has.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about where the Mueller investigation is right now. Do you have any insight on that?
It's really hard to have much insight into it. Mueller has kept such a lid on his activities, but the impression I get is that there is just a lot of pent-up movement. We're waiting for the midterm elections to finish, and then I think we're going to see a flurry of activity from Robert Mueller. I think we're going to see more indictments, and I think he's going to he is very close to coming down the home stretch with his report.
Do you think he has some sort of spectacular finish?
I think that it's inevitable that it will be spectacular. Whether it is, like, as I said, some kind of holy cow revelatory thing that we have had no glimpse of until now, or just the accumulated detail that he's been able to amass over the past year and a half. I mean, each indictment that we've seen from Robert Mueller has told us so much about this plot, so much about the criminality of people like Paul Manafort. I mean, they've been astonishing in their level of detail, and I fully expect that that will be true in the end.
But Trump's team, the president himself particularly, may have just been the unwitting beneficiaries of Russian malfeasance, right? It's not like, except for that dang meeting, that bizarre meeting they had in Trump Tower, we really don't have any evidence that there was any collusion. Would you agree with that?
I think I can come close to agreeing with that, but I would quibble with it in a couple ways. I think that to say that they're not aware of the effort that Russia was making would mean overlooking the approach that they got about that Trump Tower meeting and the way they handled it. It also, I mean, when we talk about collusion, we now know that, for instance, when Trump says, Russia, if you're listening, Russia, in fact, was listening and launched a spear phishing attack on Hillary Clinton's servers within hours. So the fact that some of this happens out in the open as opposed to hidden kind of emails or encrypted channels makes it hard for us to process. And then the Trump team tried to make good, right? You have Mike Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor, promising Russia basically in a secret phone call in December 2016, sit tight, don't worry about these sanctions that Obama's slapping on you. We're going to take care of you very soon. So there is aspects of a quid pro quo when you look at it that way.
It was a hell of a statement that he made when he said, Russia, if you're listening. And, you know, that's the president just being flip. We will never know how seriously to take this guy. But maybe the Russians took it seriously. Do you think that they actually then released those email or, you know, initiated their cooperation with WikiLeaks when he said that? Was that them listening literally?
I think that they were absolutely reacting to Trump's behavior. They were following the race very closely, and they were sort of directing their activity, whether it was their disinformation through American social media platforms or the releases of emails, with almost exquisite timing. And, you know, aspects of this plot were very crude, right? Very clunky, very clumsy, a lot of misspellings in a lot of the fake info that they were pumping into Facebook. But on other areas, they were paying close attention and actually manipulating things pretty well.
When they make the movie, by the way, has this book been optioned?
We've been in some conversations with Hollywood, but no deal yet. But I hope that does happen. I think it is. I think that's an amazing story. It's an amazing story in American history, and it's just sort of one of those, as you were saying at the outset of this conversation, there are moments in this that are almost like when you're watching a horror film and the main character doesn't see a danger around the corner, and you kind of want to scream at the screen. What in the hell?
Well, I thought this moment was cinematic, and it was tiny, but you could just see this in the movie. So there's 80 Wall Street Journal reporters all packed into a hotel that they've completely rented out for the convention. And the TV is on, and they're all in a dining area grabbing their breakfast and rolls before they go off to cover the stories they're going to cover on the campaign and the Republican National Convention. And nobody's really paying attention to Trump yammering up on the TV there. But then he says that. He says, and Russia, if you're listening, release the email. The American media will treat you well if you do it. And the room goes silent. And somebody looks up and says, holy bleep. Like, oh my God, that just happened. And now he has their attention. And I never, you know, we all remember when that happened and we thought it was more bluster, but who knows? Maybe that was really a turning point or the point at which they ratcheted up their intrusion into the election.
And it was absolutely a turning point in terms of our coverage for us at the Washington Post and I'm sure other news organizations. Because, I mean, you're right. There was an attitude at that time like, oh, this Russia stuff seems like a lot of it's made up. It seems like a lot of sour grapes from the Clinton team. They're exaggerating what's going on here. But then when Trump utters those words in public, it just sort of snapped your head around. You just kind of feel like, did he really just say that? And only a year later did we learn from Mueller that, as we said a moment ago, Russia was listening and responding.
You know, I think a question for a lot of people, too. On a phone line, by the way, we're visiting with the author of the book, The Apprentice. It's about the Russian hack into the 2016 election. Pulitzer Prize winner Greg Miller from Washington Post is on the line. I think the name everybody wants to know the truth about, like, what is this guy, is Christopher Steele and the Steele dossier. Give me your 411 on that after this. Among the texts, John, the Saudis have been major funders of terrorism for decades. Every president has ignored them. This issue is not exclusive to Trump. From 847, oh my God, John Williams got a real haircut. So handsome. Yes, you can watch us online. And this one from 630, John, can you ask your guest if the Russian interference was because they knew that Donald Trump would be so divisive it would put the U.S. in turmoil? We're wrapping up an interview with Greg Miller. His book is The Apprentice. It's about the Russian hack. Give me short answers to two questions. That last one first. Is that why they did it? Did they like Donald Trump in the election because they knew he'd just make us all nuts?
That's a great question from your listener, and that listener is spot on. I mean, that was their first objective in their interference in 2016, to make democracy look dysfunctional in the United States, to give us a big black eye, to hurt Hillary Clinton. Electing somebody who loves Vladimir Putin as much as Donald Trump was icing on the cake.
Is Christopher Steele legit?
I think he is legit. I think his work is imperfect. There are problems with it. There are gaps in it. But I do see him as an honest, kind of former British spy, deeply troubled by what he was turning up and trying to get America's attention before it was too late.
Yeah, and who hired him? Did the Republicans originally hire him and then the DNC picked him up? Walk me through
that. It's a tiny bit more complicated than that. So the Republicans hired Fusion GPS, which is this opposition research company here in Washington. Republicans hired that Fusion to dig up dirt on Trump, to look into his ties to Russia. And then later, after the Republican money had run out for Fusion, they got money from the Democrats, including Hillary's campaign, and that's when they hired Christopher Steele to keep at it, to see what else he could turn up on this trail.
And I wonder if he was fabricating things or, I mean, I know he was on assignment. Did he know that Hillary Clinton was the person asking for this information?
No, I mean, based on all of their testimony, I mean, perhaps you could make an educated guess that he should have known that was the case. He knew he was being asked to look into Donald Trump as a candidate. He sort of knew the political nature of the work he was being asked to do. But he was given a very specific kind of narrow question. Help us figure out what's going on between Trump and Russia. He's been pursuing deals there for decades. He doesn't have a lot to show for it. He says a lot of weird things about Russia. What's going on?
I'm glad that you closed the book with that bizarre press conference in Helsinki, because that was just one of the, I would say, most unfortunate moments of the last 2 years. And I guess it's a logical place to stop. But you'll have to update this book in future editions, right, Greg?
I think I will, and I think we're going to learn a lot more very soon. I think the Russia headlines are going to be coming back with a vengeance in a matter of weeks.
Greg Miller is the national security correspondent at the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest is The Apprentice. Nice to talk to you. Good work, Greg.
Thank you.
That's Greg Miller from the Washington Post.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Actually,
here's John Williams.
I don't do it when I'm on vacation. This is John. We're back, though, in the Allstate Skyline studio. Appreciate you tuning in. Remember, we're here weekdays 1 to 3 and Saturdays from 10 a.m. till 12 noon on all social media, WGN King John. We also do a news click. That's a daily web poll question where we ask you about something in the news. It's Monday, so here... Oh, wait. I see that our computer voice, Elif, is eating a snack, so we'll wait for the computer to clear its throat before we ask it to tell us what today's news click is. Now the computer is laughing and I believe passing some food up through its nose. But as soon as that's all done, we'll go.
Computers
ahead and...
have to eat too, you know.
I eat data.
I don't know about that, but
producer Elif, what is the news click, please?
It's Monday, and the Bears game left me A, encouraged. We are that close. B, unsure. We lost another one. C, discouraged. We can't get over the hump.
Where are you on that, Steve? What's your attitude about this 3-3 Bears club?
I didn't see the game yesterday, but I'm okay with it.
So you're still
encouraged? Yeah.
We're We almost beat the Packers. We almost beat the Patriots, and we're 3-3. We're still in the hunt in the division.
Wasn't there a Hail Mary pass that was completed and just 1 yard away from a touchdown that would have tied the game?
Affirmative.
That was a Hail Teresa. They come up just short. A Hail Mary, actually, you'd be in the end zone.
Yeah.
Oh.
Here's what they should have done. When the guy caught the ball with 1 yard left, and then he turns and he's about to step in, and there was like 300 or 400 New England Patriots guys in the way, there was another one of his teammates standing right there, and nobody seemed to be paying attention to him. He should have given the ball to the other guy, and then the other guy would have jumped in the end zone. Touchdown, Bears! Let's go into the sports department. Kevin's been monitoring this conversation.
Are you impressed by my stat?
Yeah, it's very impressive,
thanks.
Violetta. Well done.
I read that on the TV.
Very good. Very nice. John, I agree with you, but he really, that's easier said than done. By the time that was realistic or possibility, he had, like, as you said, 300 or 400 New England Patriots all wrapped around him. I would say, to answer your news click, I would say still encouraged. No. Mitch Trubisky probably had the worst game of the season so far for him individually, yet they never really felt completely out of it because of Mitch Trubisky, and he kept making great plays with his legs, running the ball. I mean, he was great in pulling the ball down and making things happen there. Wildly inaccurate. That's an issue. He needs to figure that out quick. He did not have a good game passing, but yes, as Violetta said, you were 1 yard away from sending this to overtime against the New England Patriots. They lost by 7 and really didn't play a whole good of a game. And if you give up two special teams touchdowns and multiple turnovers to Tom Brady, you're going to lose pretty much every single time. If you don't give up those two special teams, it's a whole different ballgame. The Bears' defense, I don't think the Bears' defense was as bad as many are making it out to be. You held Tom Brady to 24 points. I realize they scored 38, but 14 of those came on the special teams aspect of the game. So the defense, to me, I thought they're okay. They certainly didn't get to Brady, but nobody really gets to Brady. He gets rid of the ball so quick. But, you know, they got some turnovers, and they got some key stops on third down to get the offense back on the field. So all those things considered, they didn't play all that well, and they still almost could have pulled this one off.
I want you to do this when you're doing sports with Ro and Anna.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of quote Violetta, you know, so go, the Bears did this, da, 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 da. And according to Violetta Podramedic, they were 1 yard from keeping that, sending it to overtime. Right.
Not to overwhelm everybody here with advanced statistics, but I saw on the TV that they were 1 yard away from going to overtime.
It doesn't make it not true. And I had to interpret what I saw on the TV because all they said was TD, which means touchdown.
Mm-hmm. Are you writing this down?
So,
but I want you to quote her. I don't want you to just say that. I want you
according
to
our traffic reporter, our inside source tells us they were just 1 yard away from sending it to overtime.
It was a completed Hail Mary, though, so that's
good. It was.
Good.
You had that accurately stated. You know, who knows, too? Matt Nagy could have went for 2 in that situation, too, if he was feeling up to it. So
I was thinking about that. I thought, you know what? Go ahead and push the button.
Yeah, they might have.
He
wouldn't answer it, but he kind of chuckled when somebody asked him about it, and he says, I think I know what I would have done. So
I listened to our coverage afterwards, but
yeah.
I knew that would be fun.
But they were very calm, right?
Nothing. Hey, these guys, I'll tell you what. We do not have coaches. They do not have the stuff to be in the NFL.
I love this Bears coaching staff, by the way. I think Matt Nagy's great. They finally have an offense that
these
looks
guys,
like...
These guys, I'll tell you what. They don't have... they are not ready for the big time.
I can't wait to talk to OB at 440 with Ro. But no, I'm so far, I'm a big fan of Matt Nagy. You know, this offense looks like a modern-day offense the way an NFL offense should run.
It does that.
In terms of the play calling, the execution always hasn't been great.
There's that. But no, I was sitting around with a bunch of guys eating snacks, watching the game, and I said, you know, when's the last time you remember, and this year you've got this, where when we need 6 or 7 yards, somebody seems to be open. And
right. And it doesn't feel impossible anymore.
Right.
And that, you know, I went on a little Twitter rant last night about Trubisky saying, basically, yes, he was not good. I admitted, yes, he was bad. He was wildly inaccurate. He completed only 52% of his passes. He threw a couple interceptions. Probably could have thrown a couple more, to be honest with you. And all that, he still had them in that game. And it feels different with Mitch Trubisky than other quarterbacks. I realize nobody wants to commit to the quarterback in this town because we've had nothing but bad quarterbacks. And anytime there's a glimmer of hope with a quarterback, everyone's like, oh my God, maybe this is it. Maybe this is it. And then the guy goes out and throws 4 interceptions and everybody's deflated and depressed and they're mad that we have a horrible quarterback town. So I get why nobody wants to commit to Trubisky. But you're lying to yourself if you don't actually think that this feels different with Mitch Trubisky and Matt Nagy and his coaching staff.
This texter says, John, they did get to Brady 1 sack. When is the last time Tom Brady was sacked?
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. But yeah, he's been sacked 9 times this year, I want to say, and that's the least amount in the NFL. So it's tough to get to Brady for a lot of reasons. They protect him, and he gets rid of the ball so quick. You blink, and he gets it to one of his quick little receivers, a 2 or 3 yard flat route or a little screen here or there. Very tough to get to Tom Brady.
I was impressed with how we were able to complete 3 passes in the last, like, 10 seconds of that game because you knew that.
I know, because the first throw was across the middle. Everyone's like, what are you doing? And then they still had 2 more quick routes.
And then they did that wide out thing with 2 seconds left.
Cohen,
and I thought,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I thought, okay, yeah. I know what you're doing. You don't want to throw a 70-yard bomb. You want to throw a 50-yard bomb, but you're not going to get to throw a
50-yard bomb. Credit to them. That was great clock management.
It was.
I mean, we were all watching, like, there's 4 seconds left.
Idea.
And he's like, okay, it worked. But, you know, it was – you take away those special teams – and it's a whole different ballgame. Bears probably win that game. They've got some work to do, and Khalil Mack obviously is not 100%. He has been a non-factor the past 2 weeks.
Okay, more sports on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis.
Thank you, John.
And Kevin Powell. We'll be quoting Violetta Padromedic with some sort of analysis. I'm looking forward to that. What time will that be, by the way?
We'll kick off. We'll have a ton of Bears talk probably right off the top of the show, and then OB is at 4:40. So maybe I'll bring that up with OB.
Drop it in, but don't. Don't flag it. Just say it. Say, well, I was listening to Violetta, and she noted that, and then just make
it. And Opie will say, who's Violetta?
What? I don't know who Violetta is.
I don't think you've listened to the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. They would not credit me with that, John.
I do know that about that. That's why I want the little subterfuge here, little Trojan horse, if you will. Other statistics on a different topic. Hey, John, it says here, do your odds improve on winning the Mega or the Powerball, winning the lottery, if you buy one ticket at several different locations? Good question. Should you buy, say you're going to buy 10 tickets, should you go to 2 places and buy 5 each, or do you buy 10 all at one? The answer to that is obvious. More locations increases your chances.
Yeah, we're not scientists, but I'm going to say yes on that.
Totally agree with you on that. John, how about day of the week or time of the day for buying the ticket of the lottery? Do those factor in also?
Yes.
I don't have a feel for that one.
I do
believe multiple locations. What's the best time?
I think 5 minutes before the drawing.
You think it's better if you
last
wait?
Last minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't know about that.
Yeah.
You do believe that small towns, rural stops, the more... you know, lost and gone the places, the better the chances, right?
The people who live there are not lost. It is their home.
It's funny you say that because I have a friend who listens to this show. His name is Dan Phillips, and he lives in Peoria. He said, hi, John, this is Dan from Peoria, and all of us downstaters always buy a lottery ticket in Chicago because that's where the winners are. It's funny how your perspective changes depending on where you are. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate your listening. Different perspective there. So the Mega Millions drawings take place on Tuesdays and Fridays. That's the ones that it's 1.6 billion. Players pick 5 numbers from 1 to 70 and then a mega number from 1 to 25. And your odds of winning that are 1 in 302 million. That's the one that's coming up. That's funny because that's the one that's getting all the attention, the 1.6 billion tomorrow and again on Friday if it rolls over. But the one that is on Wednesdays and Saturdays, the Powerball, that's at 0.6 billion, right? That's $620 million as of a couple of hours ago. So that one would be all the rage, but for this other one, drawings for the Powerball are Wednesday and Saturday. Since October 7th, they've tweaked both of these games. Now you have 5 balls out of 69, and then you pick a Powerball from 26 balls, and that means your odds are just a tiny bit better than Mega at 292 million to 1. So I was reading around about the chances that you would win both, because that's the way I roll. Your chances are better that this would happen than that would happen. You would be struck by a meteor while being attacked by a shark. Say you're in the water and you go, holy cow, I'm about to be that rare statistic that gets eaten by a shark. Because, you know, you hear about that, but the odds are not good. But then while you're there in the water, you get hit by a meteor.
Wow.
That's not very likely to happen. That will happen to you 6,000 times. Before you'll win the Powerball and the Mega Millions.
Hmm.
So, again, not very likely.
If it was twice, I'd take it.
That puts it into perspective, though.
You know, you go, oh, crap, I'm getting eaten by a shark. Oh, great, here comes a meteor. Maybe the meteor will hit the shark. I mean, who knows, right? But that scene has to happen 6,000 times before you win both of them.
You're getting ready to punch the shark in the nose, and you're like, huh, the meteor hit it first. Thank you.
I need someone to call 312-981-7200. As this is a fine and upstanding place where I work, WGN Radio, we don't have dice here. It's funny, we've got booze, but we don't have gambling. We don't have any die. Somebody call and do this little experiment for us, because they said your chances of winning the Powerball, you know, one in a few hundred million, are the same as you rolling the same number on a die 11 times in a row, which to me isn't very likely, but I could probably do that.
There's got to be some science to it. If you hold a die at a certain angle and drop it.
Right? Well, say it's a legitimate roll. Right, I got a 7. No, it'd be one die, six-sided, so I get a 1. Then I roll it again.
That's very rare if you roll a 7.
7! Okay, we got a problem. But then you roll it again, it's probably not going to be a 1 again, 2 times in a row. But what if it was? That'd happen. Okay, if you can do that 11 times in a row, that's the same as winning the lottery. It seems to me like the die scenario is more likely than, you know, these bizarre lottery chances. But we don't have any dice here. So Sue said she would do the experiment for us. Hey, Sue, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
You got you got some dice at your house?
Yeah. Do you want me to use the left, right, centers or the regulars?
Well, it's got to be. I love that game, by the way. But
I know.
Take one six-sided die. Do you have it in front of you?
Just one?
Yep. You only roll one die.
Okay. Ready? I got it.
Roll it.
Roll it.
And then roll it now.
Two.
Okay. Now pick it up and roll it again, and we need it to be a two again.
Nope. Five. Three.
Okay.
Three. There, I got two threes.
You got two threes.
Oh, good.
All right,
again.
Let's roll with it.
Okay, I need another three.
Yeah.
Yes.
What?
Oh, wait.
Three threes in a row?
If you can do this.
Three threes.
In a row. Now, if you can do this eight more times in a row, that's. Everybody just pause.
Okay.
Pull over if you're driving.
All right.
Should we?
I'm not driving.
Thank God she's not driving.
Who would have dice in there?
Okay, hold on. Wait. My producer, Ellis.
Fuzzy dice.
What?
You have fuzzy dice in your car.
Ellis said, it sounds like
I
you...
I don't.
Did you roll again?
Yeah, I got a 2.
All right, we wanted you to wait. All right, here's your assignment. Just keep doing this, okay?
Practice.
No, I'm serious.
I get 11 of something?
Here's what I'm going to do. It's 2:21. I'm going to call you at 2:51, 2:52 around there.
Okay.
I'm going to call you in a half an hour. And tell us how.
And I've got to roll dice for a half an hour?
Do you want to win $1 trillion?
You think
from
it's easy?
John?
What's the matter, Steve?
Well, do you think it's easy to win the Mega Millions?
Really? Wait a minute. I could win $1.6 billion, but it's going to take a half an hour? Yes, just roll the die for half an hour. Talk to Elif off the air right now. Let's work out the details. I'll tell you what. We will give her a pizza. Not 1.6 billion, but what's the matter, Elif?
You know what? She can decide between either getting a gift certificate for Lou Malnati's or a desktop mini Christmas tree from Tree Time.
Or a desktop mini Christmas tree from Tree Time. Or
which one will it be?
A brand new car. All right, so we'll give you your chances between our prize list, but you have to talk to Elif off the air now. And then come back in 30 minutes, and we'll see how it's going. It is 2:22. This is WGN. I'll take a break here. But do you agree with me that there's no reason to let this happen? It should not go to $1.6 billion. I have the perfect fix in a minute. Martin Smith is on a phone line. He's a correspondent for Frontline. And the piece that you're going to be able to see is called The Pension Gamble, which premieres tomorrow night on PBS. And is very relevant to people in Illinois, I would say. Actually, in a lot of states. But boy, he could do the whole episode about what happens in Illinois. Martin, this is John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, John.
So tell me a little bit about this. It's called The Pension Gamble. What is The Pension Gamble?
First of all, you're absolutely right. We could have come to Illinois to do this. We looked at Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey. We settled on Kentucky. There was no reason telling the story over and over again, and so we dug down deeper in one place. It's a story happening in a lot of states. About half of the states don't have nearly enough money to meet the pension promises that they've made to the state workers, whether it's police or firefighters or medical workers
teachers.
Yeah.
In fact, one of your first interviews is with a school teacher down there, and then you interview, and this may focus on Kentucky, but really, this is the Illinois story, too. They interview firefighters and police officers, and they say, look, the reason we went into this line of work is so that we knew that we would have insurance for life, that my wife would have insurance for life, that I could retire and have a nice existence. I ain't going to get rich doing this, but if I do this, I'm set. That's kind of the model for everybody, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And these workers put away or had a mandatory withdrawal taken from their paychecks and put into a fund. What happened on the other side is that the state decided it didn't want to raise taxes, but it wanted to pay its bills. So it took money that was supposed to go into the pension pot and used it for other purposes.
Martin,
and then
that's the story you're telling in Kentucky, right? Because that's exactly what happened in here in Illinois. You're telling me that this
is happening all over the country. It's happening all over the country. And we've got something on the order of several trillion dollars of promises made to workers that the states in the future will not be able to make. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen somewhere between 3 years and 30 years, but it's going to happen, and ordinary taxpayers are going to have to pony up the money somehow. So everybody is affected by this.
Is it fair to be critical of the people receiving the pensions? Maybe let me put it this way. Is it fair to ask them to compromise on their side? That's what they had been always promised.
Well, it's a promise. It's a contract. It's called an inviolable contract. At least those are the words they use in Kentucky. And people take these jobs knowing that they're not going to make the kind of money they might make somewhere else. But teachers, for instance, don't qualify for Social Security in many states.
Right.
And that's true in Kentucky.
And don't pay into it
either. The pension is all they have.
Yeah. So this is happening in Illinois. It's happening in Kentucky. It's happening in Rhode Island, et cetera. Do any of these states, I know the answer to this, have laws that forbid the states from using that money? It should have been saved all along for pension payments. How is it that they allowed somebody to raid the kitty?
Well, it was allowed. The state legislators and the governor shorted the pension fund. Now, there were they took some silly projections about what money would be earned in the markets, and it was wildly more than what they got, and so that contributed as well to what they had, and it made the pension all the more underfunded.
Right.
They've got one pension in Kentucky that's only 13% funded, and they predict within 3 years it'll be insolvent.
What happens then?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the state can find some money somewhere else, raise taxes, or punish somebody else. I mean, already they're trying to fix the system for the teachers, but at the same time, they're passing budgets that cut aid to education, cut, you know, money for new books and new facilities. So, you know, it's one way or the other. Somebody's got to pay, or the teachers, or the firefighters are going to have to take a hit. Already they're saying that new hires, new teachers, new firefighters, new police are not going to have a defined benefit pension. They're going to give them this 401k style plan that's a little bit better than your 401k or mine, but not as good as the defined benefit pension plan.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there are times where those of us who are trying to manage a retirement someday on Social Security and a 401k wish we had the pension. And there are other times where you're glad that you have the 401k because maybe it's outperforming a pension. Of late, as I get closer to retirement age, the more I wish I had the groovy pension that, say, my sister had. Again, nobody's getting rich, but she absolutely knows what she's going to get when she retires, and it's comfortable.
Yeah, it's a little easier to plan when you know what you're going to get. And, you know, there's a lot of people who say, once we're through this, we're at the somewhere near the end of a nine-year bull market run, and when that runs out, you know, there's a lot of people who say that, I mean, a lot of financial experts who say that we're not going to have the kind of returns we've been looking at over the last 10 or 20 years. And so these plans are not going to do as well. But the defined benefit program, at least you knew what you were going to get. And they just feel that they've been betrayed because they've made their contributions. But it's the state that's dug the hole. And what's happened, too, is they've gone to Wall Street and chased shiny objects in the form of fancy, not very transparent, high-fee alternative investments like hedge funds or private equity.
Right.
And that hasn't turned out so well either.
A couple of calls from a couple of listeners. We'll start with Prudence. You're on WGN. Hi, Prudence. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I worked from 1956 to 62. I'm 80 now, and I paid into Social Security. And then I got married, and in those days, most wives didn't work, and then had four kids. And then went back to college, got a school social work degree at the age of 51, began working, and worked 17 years. And in Illinois, you can only get one-third of your own Social Security and get your TRS that I paid into, hoping that they would invest and not spend. You can get nothing in Illinois of your spouse's Social Security, and my husband made over $150,000, so it would have been better, but legally you can't even get it. And I did check out to see whether my pension after 17 years would be more or less than my wife's share, or my ex-wife's share of his Social Security, and my pension was better. So, I mean, I made a big major decision when I went on TRS. That's my income, and I don't know if they take it away or it goes bankrupt, whether I can go back and say, hey, remember the 30 years I was married, can I go back on
Social Security,
a wife's portion of the Social Security?
Yeah, let's let him respond to that. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, that's a very sad, I mean, that's a tale I've heard over and over again. We did a program several years back called The Retirement Gamble about the private sector and people's 401ks, and they just haven't worked out well for people. And like you say, you would have done better on the pension, and you made a huge decision, and I'm sorry to hear what you report.
Yeah, but we need to honor that. I mean, I understand the need to honor it, but somebody's going to get screwed here. Maybe everybody should get screwed a little bit. Again, this is a person who doesn't have a pension and is trying to find a way out. This is why I won't get elected governor of Illinois, Martin, because...
Yes, but there promises were made, and there are states that have prudently invested the money that's been entrusted to them.
Yeah.
And there are other states that have not. And you have to take a hard look at places like Nevada, where basically they've invested in a lot of low-fee, transparent index funds and done much better.
Wisconsin is doing well.
Some of these other investments.
Yeah, Wisconsin, somebody just told me, 97% funded. They're in better shape than we are.
Yeah, so you have to look. What did they do right? What did Illinois, Connecticut, New Jersey, Kentucky do wrong? And you know, you would hope we can learn. Now, the problem is, this is like a situation where you only paid some of your mortgage for the last 10 or 20 years. And now you're paying your full mortgage, but you're not paying the back, what you didn't pay. And that's earned interest for the bank. And so it's very hard to keep up or to catch up once you've made these bad decisions.
Can anybody throw up their hands and go, bankrupt, sorry, don't have it? So, and then what would the consequences of that be?
States are in a position where they have to balance a budget. They're not like the federal government in Washington that can print money and can sell, you know, big loads of debt to China or whoever else. So the states are going to face bankruptcy, and at some point, there may be a federal bailout, but that's going to cost everybody money.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the mistakes made by a few are going to down to all of, you know, it's going to come to all of us.
It's really well told. It's also very understandable. And it is today. Martin Smith's pension gamble is on Frontline tomorrow night. Good reporting, Martin. We appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you, John, for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for doing the work. Sue's on line 7. Sue, are you still there?
Yes.
We discovered that your chances of winning the Powerball are the same as flipping a coin and having it come up the same 11 times in a row.
Not flipping a coin, rolling a die.
Oh, that's
no,
it.
A dice. Okay. Rolling a dice.
Quite a difference. Okay, so how are you doing?
Yes. Well, not good. The most I got was 3 of anything.
3 in a row.
I'm glad she's honest.
Oh, she could have said I got 10 or 11 or
yeah,
something?
Just yeah, just for the fun.
A lot of people worried that we were ruining your chances.
I know it. So now I've got good chances.
Right, right. You haven't blown it, right, yet on this.
Right.
You only got 3 in a row. Okay.
Right.
Here's what I want you to do. Go to Lou Malnati's on us and get a pizza for you and your friends, okay?
Good. Sounds great.
It's not a $1 billion, but that's the best we can do.
Yeah, that's all right.
And keep rolling.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the time, Sue. Good luck to you. Talk to Elif off the air. Rowan, Anna, talk to us next.
Did you see that the Saudis created a body double?
Isn't that the craziest thing?
For Jamal Khashoggi?
Yeah,
did you see that? And they used his clothes that he died in so they could put him out, you know, and they could show a video of him. Oh, no, he was right over here.
Now we kind of understand why they were clinging to that original story that he walked right out. Just look at the videotape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Walked right out of there.
It's funny, though, because he went to a different house when he got home. I mean, so you're that guy. Do you then have to live the life? How long do you have to carry on the ruse, you know?
He went to some bathroom when there was video of him when he changed clothes with some other guy who had a bag of clothes, and boom, he changed clothes and was in totally his own clothes.
Yeah.
Dumped the others.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Not adding up. Not adding up.
I got problems with all these people.
Mm-hmm.
Every single last one of them, including the Crown Prince, and I get to say it. And I am not going near anywhere with a bone saw. That's where the way I'm looking at this.
Do you hear that they said that when you're doing that, you should put on headphones so that the sound of the body being dismembered isn't
so alarming? Them to listen to the music. Yeah, listen to music. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I'm glad I'm back. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Very cheery note.